Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 16, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speakers will be Moen C. Bai, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Valmont Industries, Incorporated, an Omaha-based company that manufactures irrigation equipment and other metal structures and components, and E. Robert Meany, Senior Vice President at Valmont. They'll speak on the topic, Is a Global Water Crisis Avoidable? Their presentation was given as the annual Lewis E. Harris Lecture on Public Policy, presented as part of the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Harvey Perlman, Chancellor of the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
Tonight we continue our year-long examination of water. Has water, either potable or suitable for agricultural purposes, become our most precious commodity? With 7 billion humans competing for water, it seems so. Our speakers tonight come from an industry with deep understanding of water's importance. Moen C. Bai is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Valmont Industries, an Omaha-based company that manufactures irrigation equipment and other metal structures and components. A native of Denmark, he studied law at Aarhus University and graduated from the EAC College of International Business in Copenhagen. He wants me to emphasize he is not a lawyer. He is also a graduate of the Harvard Business School's Advanced Management Program. He joined Valmont in 1979 as a regional vice president based in Hong Kong, assumed his current title in 1997. He serves as a director on a number of corporate boards and nonprofit agencies, including Conagra Foods, the Omaha Zoological Society, the Robert B. Daugherty Charitable Foundation, the Peter Kiewit Foundation, and the Nebraska Medical Center. E. Robert Meany is Senior Vice President at Valmont Industries, where he has oversight of corporate legal and compliance activities, coordination of international growth initiatives, and government affairs. During his 16 years with Valmont, Meany has been deeply involved in development of the international organization and the company's market entries into China, Brazil, and India. Meany received his MBA from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, serves on the boards of the Groundwater Foundation and the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce and Industry, where he chairs the Manufacturing Council. He is also a director of the Washington, D.C.-based National Association of Manufacturers. Their lecture tonight focuses on the global crisis in the supply and quality of water for agriculture. The freshwater crisis manifests itself differently in many locations, and the solutions they will propose include reliance on scientific advances to governance and economic development strategies. After their remarks, you will have the opportunity to ask questions by writing them on cards provided by the ushers. The discussion of ideas and questions will be moderated by Dr. Lloyd Ambrosius, Chair of the E.N. Thompson Forum Committee, and UNL Samuel Clark Waugh Distinguished Professor of History. They have entitled their lecture, Is a Global Water Crisis Avoidable? Please join me in welcoming Moen C. Bai and Robert Meany.
The lights are such up here that we can't see you, so if you decide to leave, with the last one leaving, please let us know so we can stop talking. Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for inviting Bob and I to come here and talk to you about a subject that's of great, great interest to both of us. Let me start by saying, before you get your expectations up, we're not scientists, we're not researchers. We're business executives who have been involved in irrigated agriculture all over the world for decades. Some of the facts and figures that we will give you tonight are from recent research publications of the World Bank, the Food and Agricultural Organization of United Nations, which is also known as the FAO, the International Water Management Institute, and McKinsey & Company. Today, just to set the stage, agriculture uses two-thirds of the world's fresh water. It is estimated that the world's food production will have to double in the next 30 to 50 years to keep up with a rising demand. That is obviously not possible unless agriculture becomes much more efficient in how it uses the world's freshwater resources. So it does beg the question, is a global water crisis avoidable? The short answer, in our opinion, is yes, but. We approach the question like we would any business challenge. We start by looking at the major drivers influencing the answer to this question, and from there we get more and more granular as we search for answers and strategies. We will not present to you tonight a precise roadmap how to solve a looming global water crisis. The potential solutions have many aspects, and they are complicated. However, we will outline areas of focus and highlight public and private institutions that will be helpful in addressing this challenge. And we will give you some examples of successes to date from various parts of the world. We firmly believe that the developing water crisis is not so much one of scarcity of water as it is one of management and governance. And this is an important assumption, that the amount of fresh water on Earth is sufficient to feed a growing population and feeding it better. And that is only going to happen if we govern and manage our resources more effectively. The main drivers, as we look at this question, and what would be influencing the world's capacity and challenge, are population, land, and water. We will address each of them in some detail. Let us start with the state of population and the demand for food it creates. Dramatic changes in human development on this planet are driving the increasing demand for water. Over the last century, agriculture transitioned from a local family activity to a global enterprise. Today, agriculture is dependent on complex systems like free trade among nations, commodity trading, global logistics, and the volume and scale of food and fiber demand and the water needed for its production have become immense. The driver of this exponential growth has been the call for more food. This demand has resulted from the rapid population growth. Today, there are 7 billion people on Earth. Poverty and malnutrition are the two biggest problems we face. 3.4 billion of us, or about half, live on less than $2 a day. Think about that, less than $2 a day. In China, one-third of its population live on less than $2 a day. In India, three-quarters, 75% of the Indians live on less than $2 a day. Half of all the children in Southeast Asia and Africa are stunted in growth. This is a striking picture, but it does get even more chilling, because by 2050, there will be about 9 billion people on Earth. And of all long-term predictions like GDP, climate change, commodity prices, etc., etc., these projections of population growth are the most certain, because the basic drivers are already in place. Birth rates do not change over time. They change over generations. Do not change overnight. They change over generations. But there's yet another certainty. As the billions of people who are now very poor struggle to enter the middle class, they will demand better diets, including more meat. Meat protein requires far more resources to produce than vegetable protein. More meat means more consumption of water, of land, and of energy. According to McKinsey, the middle class will gain 3 billion members by 2030. 3 billion. Consequently, a country like China will increase its meat consumption by 40% by 2030, and even then, their consumption will be far below what our consumption is in this country. So this combination of population growth and the rising income is the basis of the commonly accepted projection that, as I talked about, food production will have to double by 2050. Demographer Joel Cohen of Columbia University tells us that during the next few decades, the profile of the world's population will change dramatically. Migration from rural communities to urban will be a big factor. Massive numbers of people all over the world will move into cities. India's population will surpass China's only 10 years from now. And sub-Saharan Africa will surpass India's population by 2040. And by 2100, the United Nations median projection tells us that there will be 5 sub-Saharan African people for every European. And that will be 1/3 of the world's population. A country like Nigeria alone will have more than 750 million people. Dr. Cohen also tells us that city populations will grow from 3.5 billion this year to 6.7 billion in the next 40 years. To put that in perspective, that means that one new city of 1 million people will be formed every 5 days. Every 5 days over the next 40 years. Think about that. Thousands of new cities will be built, and rural populations will end up there. And the 3 billion new members of the middle class, they will be urban dwellers. They will be consumers of food, not growers of food. Let's switch and take a look at land. According to the FAO, land under cultivation has grown to some 1.5 billion hectares, or 12% of the land on Earth. Just think about it. Just 12% on all land on Earth is being cultivated today. Since 1960, global irrigated lands have more than doubled to 277 million hectares, and they are 18% of the cultivated land. And all the lands best adapted to agriculture, whether rain-fed or irrigated, it's already under cultivation. So the potential to cultivate more good land is generally limited to areas in South America and sub-Saharan Africa. India and China have special importance when it comes to land. Together, they have 40% today of the Earth's population, but they only have 20% of the Earth's arable land. China and India are some of the main drivers of the population projections that I just mentioned, and the result is a dramatic drop in cropland available per person. As we move forward and look around the world, not much new land can be brought into production. McKinsey estimates that by 2030, up to 30 million hectares of the world's highest quality farmland, or about 2% of it, will actually be displaced by expanding cities. Another 30 million hectares will be lost to salinization and other forms of degradation. But offsetting this loss, 100 million hectares will be brought into production for food, feed, and biofuels. But most of that new land, usable for agriculture, as I mentioned before, is in South America and in sub-Saharan Africa. And that is far from the booming middle classes I mentioned in Asia. So transportation, logistics, and cost of other kinds will be significant to move the foods from where it's produced to where it will be consumed.
Let's now turn to the state of fresh water used in agriculture. First, it's important to remember how little fresh water we have at the margin. Only 3% of the water on Earth is fresh, and that two-thirds of that is in the polar caps. This leaves only 1% of all water available to us. Of that, two-thirds is used in irrigated agriculture. In some places, like North China, parts of India, and Pakistan, up to 90% of fresh water is put to good use for irrigation. The 18% of cultivated farmland that is irrigated produces 40% of crops. The rest, 60%, are produced by rain-fed lands. The irrigated production tends to be more reliable in output. In some regions, like the high plains of North America and Northeast China, irrigated agriculture has managed to dramatically raise total production without a proportionate increase in the amount of water used, thus achieving more crop per drop. This suggests that investments in irrigation have been relatively successful in these regions. Irrigation has also brought the benefits of increased rural incomes and lessened pressure for land expansion and encroachment on nature. The reliability of irrigated crops also underlies modern supply chains and supports what the FAO calls the sustainable intensification of agriculture. All this adds up to irrigation supporting economic development around the world. This quote from the recent FAO report says it well. Agricultural water enables households to improve and stabilize crop productivity, grow high-value crops, generate high incomes and employment, and earn a higher implicit wage rate. Poverty rates are consistently lower for irrigated areas. On the other hand, the World Bank has stated that, globally speaking, investments in irrigation have had poor returns over many decades. Low grain prices and the huge expense of building canals, dams, and other infrastructure have had a negative impact here, but there is also a need for better water management and better technology than we have today. The effectiveness of irrigation is influenced by soil quality issues like waterlogging, salinity, sterilization, and by water quality and availability. There was a great expansion of irrigation around the world during the 20th century. Between 1900 and 1960, world population grew 3.5 times, but water withdrawals multiplied by 6 times. In many irrigation regions, groundwater or surface water is fully appropriated, and its use is restricted by regulators. There's a need for policies at the local level to remediate and prevent damage caused by improper irrigation methods. Best practices need to be implemented to simultaneously raise production and ensure the sustainable use of land and water. There are great differences among regions in crop production per drop. So best practices should help those regions which have lower productivity. Water's cost and availability are related to energy in many ways. Water is diverted to produce hydropower. It's used in huge quantities to affect condensation in fossil and nuclear plants. And it's a major input for mining and oil extraction. One of the biggest global consumers of energy is irrigation itself. In California, for example, 19% of electricity is used for running irrigation pumps. And in India, the number is 20%. Energy subsidies are common in agriculture. As groundwater reserves diminish, the cost of pumping from deep wells becomes significant. Megaprojects like China's South North Transfer Project and Libya's great man-made river likewise consume huge amounts of energy just to move water closer to irrigation projects or population centers. So when the cost of energy rises, the cost of water rises with it. Let's now take a quick tour of the rivers and aquifers that are essential to irrigated production of food and fiber. Here in the high plains of the U.S., irrigators rely heavily on the Ogallala Aquifer, which is subject to depletion, especially in its southern reaches, where recharge is limited. In California, our nation's leading food producer, agriculture is again limited by water. The Colorado and Rio Grande rivers have been diverted and are now fully utilized. Much of the rest of the country has rain-fed agriculture and is serviced richly by the huge Missouri and Mississippi systems and by the world's largest freshwater system, the Great Lakes. In Mexico, a number of aquifers supply agriculture, and some are being depleted. The Conchos and other rivers are fully appropriated and subject to regulation. Agriculture in the central plateau of Mexico is supported by rain and snow-fed aquifers in a line from El Paso down to Mexico City. Brazil is very rich in both surface and groundwater. It is home to the Amazon and its rainforests, which are an important part of the Earth's ecology. The Brazilian government is conscious of the great water asset it has within its boundaries, and it supports improvement in land and water productivity with research and subsidies. Argentina's high agricultural productivity is driven by the private sector. In both countries, along with Chile and Colombia, have good land and water reserves, along with decent infrastructure and skilled farmers. These factors allow for increases in irrigated and rain-fed food production throughout South America. Most of Europe is endowed with a moist climate, many rivers, and lots of groundwater. Irrigation is used extensively to enhance production. Moving over to Africa and the Middle East, the Nubian aquifer in southern Egypt and Libya is a non-replenished or fossil aquifer that is expected to last about 35 more years. Egypt and Sudan have a compact that governs the Nile, which feeds an 11-country area and should be a future major cropping area. Sub-Saharan Africa has vast water supplies in its aquifers and rivers. Africa's biggest agricultural producer is South Africa, which has a good balance of large and small farms, many dependent on irrigation. Most of the rest of Africa has small farms with limited infrastructure and very low productivity. However, the potential production of Africa, both rain-fed and irrigated, is enormous with its long growing season and three huge river systems, the Nile, the Congo, and the Niger. The fossil aquifers underlying Saudi Arabia are already seriously depleted. Turkey, Iraq, and Iran have long traditions in irrigation and are heavily irrigated. Russia, Ukraine, and the Central Asian republics are well equipped with surface water and include vast, heavily irrigated areas with large project infrastructure, which is from the 1950s and deteriorating. Turning to the rest of Asia, which contains 70% of the Earth's irrigated area, India and Pakistan contain a number of rivers fed by the water and ice of the Himalayas. The largest irrigation project on Earth lies in Pakistan along the Indus River, where the irrigation infrastructure, which covers an area roughly the size of Nebraska, is old and in need of recapitalization. India and Pakistan jointly manage the six rivers descending from the Himalayas, which feed this project. During the past two decades, well development in several regions of India has seen explosive growth, possibly beyond the ability of recharge to keep up with use. All the major rivers from Pakistan and India across to China depend on the Himalayas, where there's a huge amount of moisture and a dramatic drop in altitude. This water enables electricity generation and irrigation in seven major river basins that are home to half of mankind. These rivers feed irrigation in China and India, which are number one and number two in food production globally. China presents a unique set of water management issues under the themes of enormous demand, a desire for self-sufficiency, massive civil projects, industrial use, and aggressive water management initiatives. Water pollution remains a persistent and limiting issue in China. China has 22,000 large dams, half the world's total. China's State Council has identified water-saving irrigation as a national priority. Japan, Korea, and Southeast Asia are also heavily irrigated with a traditional rice culture. Japan and Korea are significant importers of meats and staples. Australia has reached its limit on water withdrawals, and it is home to some of the most innovative water management policies and governance systems. New Zealand has seen dramatic growth in irrigated hectares during the past 5 years to support its dairy expansion. There are huge opportunities in each of these major production regions to improve water policies, management, infrastructure, and technology. We will discuss some of these opportunities a little later after we identify some complicating factors. There's just as much water in the world now as there was at creation. Fortunately, unlike oil, it is not gone forever when we use it. Fresh water infinitely follows its cycle. It evaporates from the sea, falls as rain onto crops and into watersheds. It seeps into groundwater and runs in streams, supporting the ecology of the planet. However, as you have just seen, this resource is under pressure because of increased demand, especially in Asia. We will need research and cooperation to understand the impact of climate, human activity, and other forces to ensure that we have enough water where and when we need it.
Thank you, Bob, for a quick trip around the world. And before we give you some examples of how we can avoid a global water crisis, we want to talk about a couple of potential complicating factors. If you would imagine for a moment a world of just one country, with all regions living in peaceful harmony, we could provide and produce food where it's the most efficient to produce and transport it where it is consumed. We wouldn't have to worry about international trade. We wouldn't have to worry about potential or actual conflicts between countries or any local concerns about food security. The water issue is a vital element of this larger issue, food security. And global food security, in turn, is a major element of national security for this country and other countries. Influenced by culture and history, each country has its own policies and strategies to ensure their local food security, whether that's the most efficient place to grow food or not. For example, we see China developing relationships with the regions that border China, and they invest in agricultural land in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. There's another potentially complicating factor, and that is the historically low profitability associated with farming. And this, of course, brings us to a sensitive subject. The one thing we see certain to change in agriculture is the price of agricultural commodities. And increased prices may be essential to make some of the enormous investments and social changes that are needed to continue to feed the world. Over the last century, the cost of food as a share of family spending has steadily dropped in the developed world. Commodity prices, aside from an occasional spike, have not advanced until very recently. We do believe that the demand for food will support these higher commodity prices, and that, as a result, food will take over a larger share of consumer spending going forward. Now, the usual reaction to this kind of prognosis ranges from concern to outrage. People say that people will riot in the streets. And the negative side of this whole issue gets the most attention. Policies often are focused on lowering commodity prices. However, extremely low commodity prices will only make the problem harder to solve. To produce the food we will need, huge investments in water management, in roads, vehicles, farm equipment, utilities, schools, hospitals, and everything you can think about that's important elements in rural infrastructure will be critical. It will be necessary to invest much more in agriculture and to pay for that investment with profits earned through reduced production cost and, yes, somewhat higher commodity prices. Now, for certain, the world's poorest must be shielded from the impact of higher food prices. But the argument can also be made that a large portion of the world's poorest people live off the land, and their lot in life will only improve when they can earn a decent living from farming. The global scale of this complexity of this issue makes us believe that only free market modulated by protection for the world's poorest can get us where we need to get by 2050. Food production is by far the largest industry in the world. Like any other industry, it will only get more productive and more efficient if it produces a level of profit that allows it to reinvest in new technology to drive further efficiencies. And in turn, all of the companies that supply agriculture, seed companies, irrigation companies, equipment companies, service providers, and on and on and on, they will all invest in better products with more productivity and so on and so forth. It's all interlinked, but it does start with the economic viability of the ultimate user, the farmer. This is a very interesting quote, and it's interesting the organization that issued the quote, the Chinese Academy of Science. And it was published when prices were at a high level in 2008. And it illustrates this very point. And as you can see, they say, if the high prices of agricultural products stay high for an extended period of time, it may change the history of agricultural development. Agriculture's torment in the past is that the price of its output was always expected to fall. And so it was not a sector that attracted a lot of investment. If this is no longer true, it may be that the agricultural economy is entering into a new era of development with higher prices, which will be expected far into the future. The status of agriculture and the economy as a whole will be enhanced. More investments will be attracted. And ultimately, this means, of course, that there will be improved agricultural productivity and continued high output. This is a very important quote of all places from China. So food security will require profitable agriculture on large farms and small farms at a scale we have not seen before. Policies need to be developed to encourage this development, not to hinder it or prevent it. New technologies that lower cost or improve productivity can only emerge if we reward their inventors and their investors.
We now turn to some examples from around the world where progress is being made towards addressing the challenge of more efficient water use for food production. Much is being done and is yet to be done in the area of governance and policy. Every region and watershed needs to develop water governance which allows agriculture to thrive within the limits of sustainability. Some ideas already in practice may be transferable. Australia has developed a water trading system as a result of the recent prolonged drought. Nebraska has a unique natural resources district system, and these are empowered to regulate irrigators, levy taxes, and make investments. Another governance issue is new land being brought into production via a number of mega projects for agricultural development, especially in Africa, South America, and Southeast Asia. These projects, which often have impressive infrastructure, are financed by governments or venture capital. They attempt to develop so-called empty land. Because this land always has some type of owner already in place, the approval process for these projects must be thorough and transparent. Only time will tell if these projects will contribute significantly to the search for productive new land. Without infrastructure, we will not have a very efficient agriculture. In our opinion, it's mostly the responsibility of governments to deliver basic infrastructure to agricultural regions. Without roads, electricity, and water, we cannot expect farmers to invest in seeds, fertilizer, services, and equipment to improve their operations. And without good infrastructure to bring their products to market, we will continue to see vast amounts of produce go to waste. One of the best examples of investment in agriculture in a developing country setting has been the experience of Brazil over the past 40 years. In the 1970s, Brazil decided to invest in making the most of its agricultural potential. Brazil is endowed with the natural resources needed to be a great producer. It has water, land, a long growing season, and diversity of species. To this, Brazil added a steady commitment to infrastructure spending, building roads, terminals, ports, and establishing university and government research, extension services, favorable equipment financing, and environmental supervision. The result is a productive agriculture that has become a driver of economic growth. Brazil's farmers, both large and small, are among the world's best in terms of technology, and they are competitive on the world market. Brazil is one of the few countries in the world with an irrigation minister at cabinet level. We also need successful infrastructure projects in less developed countries. One example is the growth of VegPro, a privately owned grower based in Kenya. VegPro has established highly productive large farms linked with smaller outgrowers. They produce flowers and high-quality vegetables for European and African export markets. They currently employ 7,000 workers, 75% of whom are women. VegPro directly farms 2,500 hectares and works with smaller growers who farm a total of 750 hectares. Sustainable farming and irrigation practices are in place for each commodity produced, and waste is minimized. The horticultural industry in Kenya has over time become the country's number one foreign exchange earner. Kenya supplies 40% of Europe's roses. VegPro is about to start a similar operation in Ghana, taking advantage of that country's logistical advantages. The Millennium Challenge Corporation, a unit of the U.S. government's executive branch, is advisor to the smallholder portion of the Ghana operation. The best news is that VegPro is not unique. There are many new private projects across Africa in places like Mozambique, Angola, Rwanda, Malawi, Tanzania, and Ethiopia. These examples of private enterprise and what farmers do when confronted with opportunity are definitely parts of the solution for producing more food with less water. But in addition to private actions, coordinated actions among private enterprise, governments, universities, and NGOs are needed. Better governance is required in many areas. Successful models exist, but even better ones are needed. Free trade is necessary to move commodities from water-rich regions to those less able to produce. Subsidies and aid should be focused on establishing basic rural infrastructure, extension services, and education. Public investment should be focused on supporting both large and small farms. In turn, profits in agriculture will encourage research and innovation by private companies and universities.
So the question now is, how will these coordinated actions among government, business, universities, and others that Bob just talked about, how will this happen? We believe that institutions like the Doherty Water for Food Institute here at the University of Nebraska will help develop the means to bridge the gaps that exist among all the players by focusing on important matters of policy and of science. And under the leadership of its new executive director, Roberto Lenten, the Doherty Institute will play a crucial role in water policy and technology research, and, equally important, its practical application. The Institute will draw upon the very best talent within the university and around the world. If 10 years from now you are somewhere in Nebraska, elsewhere in the U.S., or in another country, and people tell you of an agricultural water challenge that they encountered, that the Doherty Water for Food Institute at the University of Nebraska helped them solve, then we know that the Institute is a success. Institutions will have to think creatively about this challenge, and our best minds must be put to work with very urgent timelines. We do not know what the exact solutions will be to address the food security challenge, but we are convinced that sustained strong demand for food will absolutely force the issue. There will certainly be improvements in the productivity of large-scale production agriculture, improvements like drought-resistant seeds and precision irrigation controls. They're expensive, and investments in these technologies require a return. However, we also believe that the future will bring profitable agriculture to smaller farms, those under 10 hectares. We say this because there will be incentives for smaller farms to use research and technology to improve their productivity. It will be supported by government, universities, and private firms. And farmers in China, in Brazil, in Africa will add their own ingenuity, and they will create new ways to produce the food we will need. For example, co-ops of smaller farmers like we have seen throughout Europe and the African VetsPro model can be developed with involvement of small farmers. Efforts like these will narrow the productivity gap between developing countries and today's major producers. We believe, along with many researchers, that the water crisis we are beginning to experience is not so much of scarcity, as I said at the beginning of this presentation, as it is one of management and of governance. The solutions must be implemented at a very local level, and they must take care of the poor. But they will work only if we have very good cooperation across borders and between institutions, and including private industry. And we have to have the resolve appropriate for this important mission. You've just heard examples from around the world of people working together and achieving concrete results. This must now become a way of life everywhere to avoid a global water crisis. This challenge of water and food production is actually one that is poorly understood by most people around the world, which is amazing, but that is a fact. There are not many audiences who would sit as patiently as you have tonight, that is, if you're still here, through a presentation on this subject. The agriculture and policy communities involved in solving this problem must do a better job of defining the problems and discussing the solutions. Now, if I was young today and contemplating which discipline to pursue, I cannot think of a more exciting challenge than to contribute as to how we are going to help feed the world going forward. Education, research, business, farming, policy, governance, you pick the area best matching your talents and your ambitions. And I can promise you, you will make a difference. Thank you very much for listening tonight.
Thank you. If you have questions, get a card from one of the ushers and then write your question, give it back to the usher, and those will be brought to the front here so that we'll have the opportunity to learn more. While we're gathering the questions, let me begin with some questions that come from the Thompson Scholars, the group of students who have studied these issues and who earlier had the opportunity to meet with Mr. Bai and Mr. Meany. The first question for you, and either one of you can answer or both of you can answer the question. Are there any developing countries that have been particularly adept at employing or facilitating good water consumption strategies? And can these practices be replicated in other developing countries?
I would say that there are a number of developing countries that put a tremendous effort into the development of policy and technology around water. And they're more or less scattered around the world. There are several in South America. Chile comes to mind. In Southeast Asia, where there's more of a rice culture, there's a lot of work being done to develop ways to better and more efficiently use water in the raising of rice.
And I would say that you will get more attention on that issue as the whole issue confronting countries as it relates to food production will become more and more of an acute problem. You've seen in China over the last few years a tremendous focus on how they stretch their freshwater resources. And they are investing in modern irrigation technology and better farm equipment and better inputs. So I think it will be driven as we move forward and realize more and more how important this problem is.
Thank you. A second question from the students. Some areas of the world, most famously Israel, have begun using drip irrigation to preserve water in dry and desert regions. Does the use of technology such as this justify agriculture in a desert, or should we focus on farming more arable lands that will be more water efficient?
First of all, Israel has been dealing with a very scarce commodity, water, throughout their history, and they have developed a very precise low-volume irrigation system because they basically have very small farms. There are basically only two technologies that will deliver water efficiently for agricultural production. One is the center pivot industry, which was started in Nebraska, and low-volume irrigation, which is drip, microsprays, and tape. Now, the question on Israel is really one that I touched upon when I talk about national security. It may not be the most efficient way to use water that is scarce or land that may not be that productive. But if you are in Israel, you will do whatever you can to make sure you do have food security in that country. So that goes back to the whole issue of the complicating factors. If Israel didn't have to worry about national security, they would probably grow their food in Sudan, not in Israel. Sudan has better water and better soils.
Okay, I have several questions, and let me try to lump them together, and they relate to center pivot versus drip irrigation. What are the advantages of one over the other? Why is one more efficient than the other? You know, obviously, Valmont is involved with center pivot, but is that the most efficient, or would some form of drip irrigation be a better option?
Today, the efficiency rates of both is about the same, but they have different applications. Center pivots are because of the size of the equipment for larger fields, larger farms, broad acre agriculture. Drip irrigation is mostly used on smaller, irregular plots and higher value added crops such as vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. So they are the two technologies that together will help us solve this problem. But they have a little overlap, but otherwise they have their own places where they're the most efficient.
One of the reasons we see drip irrigation quite a bit in desert environments is because in areas that are limited by their water, where agriculture is limited by the water supply, it's logical to go to higher value crops. So over time, we've seen drip irrigation maintaining its share of very high value crops, whereas grain crops are more commonly irrigated with center pivot irrigation.
What is Valmont doing to increase the efficiency of irrigation techniques?
A lot. And maybe I can best explain it by reminding people when the center pivot industry was established all the way back in the early 50s. The whole purpose of a center pivot was to deliver water uniformly on a field, as opposed to pumping it in one end of the field and have runoff at the other end of the field. So it was to apply it uniformly and frequently, particularly on sandy soils. The future of irrigation is the reverse. You have to apply water specifically by square yard in a field, depending on the soil, depending on the crop condition in that particular part of the field. So you use soil moisture maps, infrared photography to measure the stress on the crop, and you then have computers calculate what the irrigation pattern should be per square yard. And you then have the ability to turn on and off each sprinkler on the irrigation system so it only delivers the amount of water necessary for that small plot or part of the farm. That's the next level of efficient use of irrigation.
A couple of questions that relate to diet. Why do we promote a meat protein diet or a diet that is more difficult to raise in terms of inputs when we know that requires more water?
Well, that's a good question, but so far we haven't gotten to the point where we tell people what they can eat. but it's clear that if everybody on Earth were vegetarians, this problem would be easier to solve. Maybe not by a lot, but it would be easier.
What is the impact of price supports on the global water future?
Price support of commodities or price support of...
I suspect that they refer to agricultural subsidies, although I don't know since I don't know who wrote the question.
Okay. Well, I think as it comes back to the profitability of agriculture, as agriculture is very profitable, in general, some of these subsidies are not necessary. And it goes back to eventually you will have to have that profitability in agriculture to continue to drive efficiency improvements. Now, the big issue is that you have more than 3 billion people that live off $2 a day, and they don't spend, like we do in this country, 15% of disposable income on food. They spend 100% of it. So we need to find ways, country by country, to solve that problem. But that's a problem that should be solved, and it should not be we keep commodity prices at the low levels we have seen over the last 100 years.
What do you think about biofuels in relationship to food security and the water crisis?
We talked about that with the students earlier this afternoon, and it becomes a question of how do you prioritize the use of water. Now, we are fortunate in this country. We are the largest exporter of agricultural commodities. We have the water resources to grow our agricultural commodities. But if it came down to in a country somewhere in the world, you're either going to grow an agricultural commodity for fuel or you're going to grow it for food to make sure people have full stomachs. There's no doubt what the priority would be. So it all depends on each country's individual situation.
You addressed the issue of limited water resources, but would you please share your opinion on the impact of increasing use of pesticides and herbicides, what that impact will be on clear drinking water resources, especially in developing countries?
Well, it all depends on how you apply those pesticides and other chemicals. If it's done in a prudent manner and it's done at the quantities necessary to help plant growth and it's managed well, it will not be a problem. But if it is not managed well, it will pollute water. So it all comes down to management and governance of these chemicals.
This will be the last question for you. You spoke of the world as one nation and the assumptions inherent with that premise. What is your opinion on the efficiency of water management in the United States, where technology is needed and less complicated governance is the rule?
Well, in general, we are probably much more sophisticated in that area as many places. But there are countries like Australia and others that Bob talked about that have done a very good job, too. But I think Bob was mentioning earlier this afternoon that the same amount of water is being pumped out of wells and aquifers in the United States as we saw 40 or 50 years ago. But the agricultural production has gone up several times since that. It's much more productive, so it's a much more efficient use of water. And I think that's a good sign.
Thank you very much for your contribution to the Thompson Forum.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
You've been listening to a program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today's guest speakers were Moen C. Bai, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Valmont Industries Incorporated, an Omaha-based company that manufactures irrigation equipment and other metal structures and components, and E. Robert Meany, Senior Vice President at Valmont. They spoke on the topic, "Is a Global Water Crisis Avoidable?" Their presentation was given as the annual Lewis E. Harris Lecture on Public Policy, presented as part of the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 16, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.